Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. The WFPL News team has survived yet another week and is here to tell the tale. And joining us for our Metro News Roundup are Gabe Bullard, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, and Philip Bailey. Welcome back, everyone.
Thanks, Rick.
We also welcome your input, as always, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255, or toll-free, 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@WFPL.org. Send us a tweet, WFPL News, or get to us through Facebook. Philip, let's start with you. There's a new Metro Council member today, Attica Scott, appointed to the District 1 seat vacated by Dr. Judy Green. I turned on Metro TV about 9 o'clock or so last night, expecting the council to be on its 22nd ballot, because in the past, when they've selected new people, it's been quite a drawn-out procedure, but this time they filled the seat rather quickly.
Yeah, compared to years past, if people remember when former Councilman George Unseld died last year, to fill the District 6 seat, there were about 33, 34 ballots until it was the candidate was finally picked. In this process, it was much quicker. The council, obviously, as you mentioned, they elected Attica Woodson Scott. She will fill the seat. She's a 39-year-old community organizer, currently serves as a coordinator for Kentucky Jobs with Justice, a grassroots organization that works on labor issues, immigrants' rights, and other sort of progressive causes in the city. So at this point, it was pretty clear that that was a quick decision. The controversial part of the process, though, there was still a little bit of controversy. Councilwoman Mary Woolridge sort of blew the whistle on the process, saying that the process was rigged in Scott's favor, essentially saying that they were behind the scenes meetings with council members, and that they had already selected Scott before the interview process had begun. And, you know, behind the scenes, the people who have watched the council for a number of years have known council members really don't like picking a new person. When there's a vacancy, this is the fifth time they've done it. They've done it four previous times. They really don't enjoy this process. They would much rather have a special election. However, merger law does obligate them to fill the vacancy. And if they can't do it, then obviously in 30 days, the mayor would be given that assignment. But after Woolridge made that comment, many members started going off the track and having this conversation about, well, we would like the General Assembly to look into this and change the law. Councilman Brent Ackerson, who nominated Councilwoman Scott, he said that, you know, that Woolridge's comments shouldn't taint his nomination at all, that there was no sort of backroom deal. Courtney Phelps was who Councilwoman Woolridge ended up nominating. He was the only other nominee. The final vote was 18-7, 18 obviously voting for Councilwoman Scott and 7 voting for Mr. Phelps. So this opened up it was a weird introduction for Councilwoman Scott in that sense, that her introduction to the council was this controversy about how we pick the person and should we pick it or should the voters have a special election. But she's committed to being held to a higher standard given the scandal that her predecessor had. So this is, you know, she said that she's ready to start on day one and get working on the District 1.
And she was sworn in last night, ready to go?
Yes, she's officially the new member of the Metro Council. We now have 26 members once again. District 1, this is their fourth member of the council. I think that's the most that any council district has ever had. Obviously, they had the first person to ever resign. I mean, District 1 is sort of this weird district where there's a lot of history made. In 2005, Councilwoman Bentley was the first to resign from the council. She was replaced by Leonard Watkins, and obviously they were the first council with Councilwoman Green, the first district to ever have a council member expelled from office. Councilwoman Scott has indicated that because of that, she feels that she is held to a higher standard. She wants constituents to give her as much feedback as possible, but that she's ready to get to work.
Is this her first public office?
Yes, she did run for school board last year, Jefferson County School Board for District 1 in that seat. She obviously lost in that race, came in second behind Diane Porter, but this is her first time holding public office, and certainly, she got a lot of support from grassroots organizations. The Fairness Campaigns Political Action Committee endorsed her. I know State Representative Reginald Meeks, his legislative district, who's the legislative district chair for one of the chairs in the Jefferson County Democratic Party, his group organized and got behind and endorsed Scott. And more so than just endorsed her, said that they would support her in any reelection, which also obviously was a motivation of the council, I think, to pick Scott. And at the end of the day, it was not only her qualifications and her interview, which was a pretty good interview and one of the top interviews of all the candidates or applicants, but also the fact that they want someone who's going to be able to run an election next year, the next May primary, and who's going to win. Right now, the council's batting about 50%. Two of the people they've appointed have been reelected by the district voters, and two have not. So they're batting 50% in that realm. So that was certainly something that got into their mindset, I'm sure, when they selected Councilwoman Scott.
Now, she will serve the remainder of Councilwoman Green's term?
Well, potentially. Next year, next May, if she does have a primary challenger. I believe Councilwoman Scott is a Democrat. She could have a primary challenger. That person could obviously beat her, and she would obviously have to run in the general election. Even if she doesn't win the primary, she could face a Republican challenger in the general election. So that's the other thing that council members mentioned, that the idea of we appoint someone and they are literally voted on a few months later by the voters, why not just have a special election in the first place and just get us out of the process altogether?
All right. Thank you, Philip. We'll be coming back to you in a moment. I want to turn to WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson. Erica, big vote today in the U.S. House on a coal ash bill.
Yeah, Rick, this is something that's expected later this afternoon. They've been debating it on the floor this morning. It's most of what I've seen indicates that it's expected to pass the House.
And what exactly would this bill do?
Well, this bill basically would let states regulate their coal ash programs, which is something that's pretty much what's going on now. There's no federal regulation of coal ash, which I should probably say is the byproduct that's created when you burn coal. It's a solid, can be kind of powdery or kind of heavy material that a lot of power plants store in landfills or in impoundment ponds. And so this bill is making environmental groups really nervous because they don't feel that coal ash is being regulated by the states very well right now. And this bill would basically make that kind of a permanent thing. The Environmental Protection Agency does not regulate coal ash right now, and they've proposed two ways to do that. There are different proponents of each of the two ways. But if this bill passes, that would basically stop the EPA from regulating coal ash as long as the states want to step up and implement their own programs.
Now that the EPA proposal, these two proposals were the subject of some hearings held around the country, including down the street here in Louisville not long ago.
Yeah, and there are two options they're proposing. One is Subtitle C and one is Subtitle D. And basically the big difference is that Subtitle C would basically designate coal ash as a hazardous material, which would mean that landfills would have to treat it as such and have special protections in place. And the other one would basically just call it a special waste, and it could be disposed of like a lot of other non-hazardous materials. And the big issue here is that people who are proponents of beneficially reusing or recycling coal ash say if it's designated hazardous, that's going to create such a stigma around it that that more of this material will be landfilled and less of it will be put into products like concrete.
Now, if this bill today eventually becomes law, how would that affect how coal ash is handled here in Kentucky?
Well, we probably wouldn't see much of a difference right now, because right now we do have a state-run program, and that would basically just reinforce that state-run program, and the state would have to regulate coal ash at least as stringently as it regulates municipal waste.
All right. Thank you, Erica. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. I should pass along that we welcome your input as well, and our phone number is 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255, or toll-free 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. You can email us again at news@wfpl.org, and send us a tweet at WFPLnews, or get to us through Facebook. I want to turn now to Devin Katayama. Devin, you reported this week on some trips made by Kentucky Education Commissioner Terry Holliday and some other education chiefs from other states that have drawn the attention of the New York Times.
Yeah, and this began from an article from a columnist at the New York Times. His name's Mike Weinrip, and he was investigating or looking into some trips that were being paid for by Pearson's Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of Pearson's, the education business provider. You know, they give textbooks and stuff to low-performing schools and help in other means like that. But what he was finding was that during some of these nonprofit trips that they were, or these free trips that they were providing to several state commissioners, they were having meetings with some of the business arm partners. And what actually happened is that a lot of these states and these commissioners contracted with Pearson after the fact, after they took these trips. And what Weinrip brings up in his articles or his column is the ethical line that he's questioning on whether these free trips are, in fact, free trips. So I think it's, and Mr. Holliday has come out and said these trips, he says he's been very transparent. He even put these trips on his blog, and he says he's basically going to these countries to learn how other countries are dealing with similar economic and educational issues. But he does question and bring up the fact that, is this fair?
And these are trips to where? China and Brazil?
China, Brazil. I think there's a couple other trips, but Mr. Holliday's trips were specifically China and Brazil is what was reported. And the contract that Pearson currently has is around $57 million with the state of Kentucky. And during the bidding process for getting Pearson to contract with the state, Pearson's bid was $2 million higher than the lowest bid. But this, the Department of Education says that they just don't go off the price of a provider. They go over the entire value of what they can provide.
So Dr. Holliday says there was no conflict of interest here, but obviously there's maybe a perception that
that's an interesting thing. When you talk a lot of different industries, you do come up with this gray area of ethics. I mean, journalism is one of them where you there's certain lines that while it may be legal to cross, it's questionable of whether it just looks bad. And I think that's what Weinrip brings up in his column.
All right. And would this spark, you think, any changes in travel policy at
the
department?
I'm not sure about the department, but Weinrip definitely believes that there will be no more free trips, or at least the commissioners won't take the free trips. Because what he also brings up is that Pearson offers the trips. Pearson Foundation offers the trips. Commissioners don't have to take the free trip.
And some have turned it down, right?
Yeah. I believe the Michigan commissioner actually went on one of the trips previously, but then he recently denied it because he felt like it was, again, unethical.
All right. Thank you, Devin. We'll come back to you in a moment. I want to turn to Gabe Bullard and get an update on Occupy Louisville. And we still have some protesters out there, right?
Yeah, they're still out there. And Philip and Devin, feel free to chime in. Mm-hmm. You guys have talked with a few folks today, I believe. I went down yesterday after the rain to Jefferson Square Park, where they've moved, started at Aegon Plaza. And I wanted to see if the rain had kept people away. The temperature had dropped a little bit, see how that was going. There were about 8 people there when I first showed up. They were having a very informal general assembly. They called it informal as well, sitting around essentially talking about what they plan to do over the coming days. At that point, they still had to go to the Belvedere at night to sleep. That's something that's in progress. I know they're seeking, unless they have obtained a permit, to stay in the park all night. Have they obtained it?
They said that they've obtained it, and actually they said that a lot of them, or 8 of them, spent the night there last night. They're expecting more as people learn about the acquiring of the permit. We're still trying to confirm that with Metro government. We have an open records request in.
And even in about the 30 minutes I was down there, a few more people started showing up. It's becoming more of a fixture. They had said that even at first, sometimes people would be walking by and might stop or ask questions or look. And now they said people passing through the park on their way to the courthouse or to their office tend to just not pay attention to the protest at this point, that they're used to it, that it's this sort of fixture in the park now.
They even said that the police presence last night for the first, apparently the first night that they spent the night, there was basically no police around, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah, that was interesting because I know Russ Cosgrove, who spoke before Metro Council last night when he asked or sought support from the Metro Council, at least that's what Occupy Louisville is seeking now, he was indicating that the relationship between protesters and police was pretty amicable. There was no real dust-up like you see maybe in other cities, particularly in New York City, the headquarters of the Occupy Wall Street movement. But here it seems to be much more quaint, and I think that's obviously because you see a lot of people coming and going. You can never take a judgment of Occupy Louisville by what you see at a particular time. Sometimes I've been down there and seen 10, 15 people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll be down there and you'll see 50 people. So mm-hmm. it really is sort of this, I won't say laissez-faire, well, I just did, but you see sort of this this back and forth.
That's where, all you get, just that one.
Yeah, just depending upon when you show up and what day you show up or what time you show up. I think no one's really keeping a tally of in total how many people have showed up, but I think it's safe to say 200 different people have at one point or another been involved in Occupy Louisville.
And the people I talked to had said generally after the workday it picks up more, that people will finish their job and walk down to the park or drive over to the park and spend some time there being a part of it, whether or not they are there in the morning, whether or not they go at lunch, or whether or not they stay there overnight, either in the park or at the Belvedere. They said people do come by to show their support. One man I had talked with said, brought up this point that a few other people have made as well, that when they were having to go to the Belvedere, that essentially gave them 2 marches every day that they had through downtown. And the gentleman I talked to who was demonstrating said that it was more of a team building activity than perhaps anyone had planned, and that ended up making this core group of people who were trekking down there every day and going back and forth, it made them even a tighter knit group.
Yeah, and one thing we'll hear probably later today is, you know, Mr. Cosgrove, he addressed at least some of the criticisms of the movement, which nationally as well as locally goes on, which is that, well, they don't have any exact policies, they don't have any recommendations or demands. His point was that, you know, we're an embryonic movement that's growing, that when you have a democratic process like that, we're, the reason you don't want to exclude people is that we're all trying to sort of get on the same page. You do see different groups of folks, mostly progressives and liberal folks, but coming together around this idea of corporate greed or the income disparities or the wealth disparities in this country, and that being sort of the starting point, it's very hard to come up with an agenda, but they're doing that slowly but surely.
And a gentleman I spoke with today, too, he was saying, you know, while they're still deciding what their actions are going to be, the idea and the fact that they are taking this democratic approach is something that they hope spills over into local government. So maybe local government, now that they're outside City Hall, will take a peek and say, oh, look what's going on over there. Look how that's being, you know, going, you know, running. And they hope that their values will kind of overflow into certain areas of government.
And we do have a call on this topic. Let's go to Chuck here in Louisville. Hey, Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi there. Just wanted to say two things, actually. The first one is that this whole conversation about Occupy Louisville and just Occupy Wall Street, for that matter, is very, very important as far as how you frame the issue. We're over and over and over, we're calling it a protest movement. Specifically in Louisville, this is a demonstration. The reason, I'm not actually being super picky about that, let me explain. The reason that the difference is important is the word protest has a particular knee-jerk emotional reaction with a lot of people. And it brings up a lot of pictures that, frankly, aren't there, especially anywhere that's not in New York right now. Most of what Louisville is doing is simply standing in solidarity with the troops, if you will. On top of that, there's... Now that it's starting to gain notoriety here in Louisville in particular, you're starting to see a lot of greater coordination between unofficial members of the Democratic Party, some members of CETA, pretty much anything progressive. So you're going to see this turnout get larger and larger over the coming days. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say.
Thanks. All right, Chuck. And I assume you're part of this demonstration, right?
I'm joining the demonstration this weekend. I haven't yet gotten to it like a lot of people. Real life gets in the way of other things, but, you know, now that it's here, it's time to go.
Our audio is not very good, but I wanted to ask you, how long are you prepared to be a part of this?
Now that I've had a little time to prepare for it, I could spend as much as 2 solid weeks there, and I know that a lot of other people are making similar preparations, just in case. Louisville is blessed with having an intelligent police force, thankfully, and people that are making the demonstration are playing by all the rules. They're getting the permits, they're doing the things that they're supposed to do, while at the same time getting the message out. This isn't part of the culture war that people claim it is. This is just simply people standing up and making a voice for themselves.
All right, Chuck. Thanks for your call. Chuck's perspective on Occupy Louisville.
And I think there you see a prime example of what's going on nationally trying to happen at the local level, where you see, at least in Lower Manhattan, number of labor groups and organized parts of the left of the Democratic Party beginning to sort of flirt with the idea of Occupy Wall Street. I know Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi gave it a nod and a wink to yesterday. I know Congressman John Yarmuth via Twitter, at least his conversation with constituents, indicated that he supported the idea of what they're doing. It'd be interesting to see if council Democrats or labor groups, which just had a interesting fight about financial impact statements in the Metro Council, if they'll sort of jump on board and sort of some sort of affinity with Occupy Louisville.
That makes a nice segue to our next topic, Philip, and I turn to you. You were at the Metro Council meeting last night, and this financial disclosure issue came up. What happened?
Yeah, the bitter partisan debate around this ended up being exactly what I think observers predicted. The Metro Council Democrats passed the union exemption law of the financial disclosure law on a party line vote, 16-9, and the reason that's 25 votes is because obviously District 1 was vacant at the time. Mm-hmm. But essentially that allows for the exemption of union contracts from the financial impact statements. You saw the same debate you had seen over the past few weeks. The council Democrats saying, you know, council Republicans were trying to undermine collective bargaining agreements. They were trying to interrupt the negotiation between the mayor's office and union contracts. And council Republicans saying this is all about transparency, that this will be more difficult for taxpayers to learn the details of these agreements because there won't be a three-line summary there. I know Councilman David James, who introduced the ordinance, he did introduce an amendment that allows for the majority of a committee to
request to see a financial impact statement if they deem fit, if the majority votes that way. Council Republicans contend that the problem with that is that this is what they've done the whole time since really merger started, since Metro government, that they've requested to see these contracts, see these financial impact statements before, whether under Mayor Abramson or twice now under Mayor Greg Fisher, and they haven't gotten them. And Councilman Kevin Kramer, Republican on the council, made a point that essentially what this ordinance is doing from the Republican viewpoint is codifying the legitimizing the idea of not showing the financial impact statements. But you saw the a number of prominent people, including former congressional candidate Marilyn Parker, former gubernatorial candidate Phil Moffitt, they spoke out against the ordinance. But the council chambers was packed with union members who came out in support of the ordinance, including Ed O'Neill, a spokesman for the Louisville Firefighters Union, and including Chris Hartman, the executive director of the Fairness Campaign, who came out to speak in favor of labor and public employees.
Why would the union folks, what is their argument for why this not having this information available to the public would hurt the process?
Well, their argument is that there's a lot of these situations where you have Me Toos, where if we have these financial disclosures made publicly and these financial impact statements, that one union will go back to the mayor's office and say, essentially, you gave this union that, why aren't you giving us that? Vice versa, from the electricians to the carpenters to the police and firefighters, it could get into this Me Too situation. And as Mark Miller, Mayor Fisher's director of labor, said, the days of Me Toos are over. Council Democrats also, though, later on admit in the conversation, particularly as it got very, very partisan, Councilman David Yates made the point that this is a line in the sand, that they felt, Council Democrats felt, this was the beginning of sort of a Wisconsin-style way to undermine collective bargaining. Council Republicans obviously denied that, but Council Democrats will contend continuously that this is where it starts. Questions about transparency, financial accountability, and that they're having a preemptive strike to keep public employees safe and secure from things that went on in Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Let's go back to Erica Peterson. I want to talk about toluene for a moment. The Air Pollution Control District held a hearing on American Synthetic Rubber's plan to stop using toluene. First of all, what is that substance?
Well, this is a substance people might remember. There were two minor leaks of toluene earlier this summer, within about 2 weeks of each other. And these weren't major leaks. They didn't injure anyone. They didn't leak out into the neighborhood, from what they could tell. But toluene is regulated under the city's Strategic Toxic Air Reduction Program. It's a level 2 hazardous substance. So some people were pretty worried about that.
And why does the company want to, is going through this process to switch chemicals?
Well, they make rubber. It's American synthetic rubber. And they're pretty candid about the fact that they would not be trying to replace this unless it was good for business, because they do have a permit to use toluene. That's not an issue. But they're trying to replace it with two other chemicals, cyclohexane and methyl cyclohexane. And they say that this is a good business move. It's going to help them make higher performance rubber for tires.
Now, are there people, groups opposed to this move?
Yeah. This move, the company sees it kind of as a win-win, because cyclohexane and methyl cyclohexane are not known to be as dangerous as toluene. They aren't regulated by the STAR program. So it's better for the environment, better for human health. But it's making some people kind of nervous because there's not a lot known about these two chemicals. And there have been studies done that show if you're exposed in large amounts, some central nervous problems like headaches or dizziness. But the studies really have shown that it would be huge amounts that they wouldn't even be using in this building, much less exposing people to. But there was a public hearing. The Air Pollution Control District held a public hearing about it this week. And some of the people who were there kind of had broader concerns about chemicals in Rubber Town. Ebony Cochran from React was there, and her issue is kind of like, what's the cumulative impact of all these chemicals? Maybe they say they're switching to these two chemicals and that'll be better, but who knows, that cyclohexane isn't going to react with what the next door factory is producing and create something that's even more dangerous for people in Rubber Town.
All right. Thank you, Erica. Just a couple of minutes left. I want to get quickly to Devin Katayama to talk about the Ford contract talks. The UAW and the company have come to an agreement nationally, and now the vote is underway.
This is a really interesting vote to watch, actually. It's kind of surprising. So far, it seems almost split, with a little bit more people are less in favor of the agreement contract. Chicago and Michigan local unions recently shot down the contract. And the voting will end next Tuesday. And the local Louisville chapter is voting Tuesday. And they have one of the biggest chapters in the United States. So it may come down to the local Louisville chapter for whether this contract is ratified. And what workers are giving up, what Union Ford workers are giving up, is some of their benefits that they lost earlier, which includes things like cost of living increases or certain break time pay. But they are getting larger signing on bonuses than GM and Chrysler. And they do have, it seems like, slightly better contracts than both GM and Chrysler. So it will be interesting to watch this as it goes forward.
A lot at stake here in Louisville because the contract calls for adding a shift at the Louisville assembly plant and a $600 million investment in the truck plant.
Yeah, Ford is really investing in the Louisville area, so there is a lot hinging on this. I think it's 1,600 jobs that it would create and spinoff jobs on top of those jobs. So there is potential for a great impact in Louisville. So it'd be interesting to see if there's an overwhelming support for this because of that, or if people are really just wanting to look after their own and are unhappy with what is in the current contract.
When are they going to be voting here in Louisville?
It'll be next Monday and Tuesday. It ends on Tuesday nationwide.
All right, we'll be watching for that. Thank you, Devin. I want to end up with Gabe Bullard here because we want to get an update on the situation involving the Kentucky Opera and looking for some Louisville orchestra musicians for its season.
Yeah, last month, without the orchestra playing, there's no easy source for the opera to get musicians. Previously, when there was an orchestra season, the opera could contract with those musicians, and they had a deal worked out in how they could get enough players for the pit. Without this orchestra season going on, they've done it for one show at least, last month's performances of Carmen, create a separate contract. And it was a fairly last-minute deal with Carmen, and that's causing some friction this time. What happened with Carmen was essentially the contract that the musicians got was more than the standard union freelance contract. It was, in a lot of ways, a miniature version of the orchestra, of the collective bargaining agreement they had before. That, according to the opera folks, cost about $33,000 more than they had originally budgeted or that they had planned to pay for musical accompaniment. For next month's performances of The Marriage of Figaro, they are trying to get these musicians on something closer to the standard freelance rate. The national union representatives have said if you did one deal for Carmen, you should replicate that deal or come closer to it for future performances. The opera says they can't afford it, and that's where they're at right now. So now we see the two organizations that use these musicians, the Louisville Orchestra and the Kentucky Opera, are both at odds with the musicians and the union in essentially either what they can pay the musicians or how many musicians they need. The options for the opera right now are either compromise and give up possibly additional funds that have been budgeted, seek replacement players. I know it's upsetting, Erica,
Everybody
but
all right?
No need to throw things over this. I know you're looking forward to Marriage of Figaro, but or they can seek outside musicians, which would likely land the opera on the union's unfair list and essentially block musicians from playing for them. Or they could use pianos, which, as Ray Hare, he's the international head of the American Federation of Musicians, said. He said he asked, had I ever heard an opera performed with two pianos? And I said no. And he said, if you had, you would never want to hear it again. That it's not really the artistic experience that a standard opera performance is. And it might hurt sales. David Roth with the Kentucky Opera had said that's not going to be as appealing if there's just going to be two pianos.
All right. So talks continue, I assume.
Talks do continue, yes.
All right. Thanks, everyone. That's going to wrap it up for our A Metro News segment with our WFPL news team, Philip Bailey, Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Coming up, we'll visit with the Courier-Journal's religion writer Peter Smith, and later we'll be joined by the CJ's Chris Ottz to talk about Dr. James Ramsey's contract extension at U of L. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we invite you to join our conversation throughout the hour as we talk about the week's events. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or toll-free 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. Well, 4 years ago, Joseph Kurtz was appointed to succeed Thomas Kelly as the Archbishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Louisville, and he has hit the ground running since then. There's speculation that he may be in line for a bigger city appointment or even a promotion to Cardinal. Joining us to talk about it is Courier-Journal religion writer Peter Smith, who wrote a lengthy profile about the Archbishop earlier this month. Welcome, Peter.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Well, I guess I should disclose, full disclosure, I grew up and was educated within the Archdiocese of Louisville in Bartstown.
You are not alone.
You too, huh?
Not me, but lots of our listeners here.
Yeah. Hundreds of thousands. It's a pretty good size Archdiocese. Kurtz arrived here 4 years ago, as we mentioned, from he'd been in Knoxville. Now, he's been rather outspoken about the church's position on various social issues, abortion and gay marriage, and most recently involving the hospital merger.
Correct. A lot of eyes are on him these days because once the fine print is finally put together on the hospital merger, it will go to him, among others who are approving it. It will go to him and to his counterpart in Lexington, Bishop Ronald Gaynor, to decide whether this meets the definition of a Catholic ministry and to either approve it or not.
And he's been very steadfast about the Catholic teachings and whatnot being followed in this merger.
A lot of the discussion has been on what sort of reproductive services that the merged hospital entity can provide, and there are directives known as the ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare, and he has been very firm in saying that these rules need to be applied to the merged entity.
How has Archbishop Kurtz been received here in the community?
Well, he certainly has been very active. He has made himself involved in virtually every area of the Archdiocese, keeps a very busy schedule, has a very likable personality, is received well. He certainly is very firm about following church procedures, whether from the Vatican or the Conference of Bishops, and he has been very steadfast at that, at the same time as being, you know, very much out with the people, gregarious, you know.
Now, he's 65 years old, and most of us would be thinking about retirement at that age,
right.
But as you write in your piece, some of his biggest opportunities or challenges may still be ahead of him.
It's interesting at an age like that that he, as often, is described as a comer, as someone who is seen with as having potential. Well, last year, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops elected him as its vice president. And a lot of that, certainly he's been very active for years in the conference in a number of different areas. His colleagues know him well, but I think it's worth noting the vote came one day after he gave a very impassioned speech that sort of was the wrapping up of his role on a task force on marriage. And he was very outspoken in defending the church position against same-sex marriage, speaking out against referendums around the country, and even contributing funds in some cases against ballot initiatives or other measures to promote same-sex marriage.
Someone used the term, I don't think it was your term, but somebody in your article used the term smiling conservative.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, it's in contrast to some other bishops who may be viewed as a little more hard-edged, a little more ready to pick a fight publicly, particularly with politicians who dissent, Catholic politicians who dissent with church teaching on abortion. Someone who's viewed in that camp is Charles Chaput, who was Archbishop of Denver. There was recently an opening with the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and Archbishop Kurtz was among those considered a leading candidate, particularly since he is a Pennsylvania native. And that's often considered a position that where the Archbishop goes on to be named a cardinal as well. As it turned out, that position went to Archbishop Chaput. At the same time, of course, Kurtz himself was elected vice president, and the next leading vote getter was Archbishop Chaput. So it seems as though both types of bishops are, if they are considered solidly or conservative, they are doing well within the church.
And you mentioned the possibility of Archbishop Kurtz being named the Archbishop of Chicago, which was 2.3 million members, huge archdiocese, possibly even being promoted to cardinal. What's he have to say about all this?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Yeah. If you ask him about other things, including, you know, why he might have been appointed elected vice president of the USCCB, he'll comment. He'll say, well, you know, maybe it's because I'm very interested in public policy. My colleagues know that, and you know, certainly that he's been out and about on these issues. But when you ask him, what about speculation about Philadelphia, about Chicago, about Baltimore, he'll not want to comment on that.
And it's not unusual for someone of his age to or archbishops to move around, even though at age 75, correct me if I'm wrong, they have to submit a letter to
right.
the Vatican saying that they are ready for retirement.
Right, right. And, you know, no, it's not unusual at all for someone at that age to do that.
I want to ask you about something else. We've been talking a lot this week in the news about these Amish men who have been prosecuted in parts of Kentucky for defying a law that requires them to place this bright orange-red safety triangle on their horse-drawn buggies. Why is it do they oppose that symbol being on their buggies?
This is a particular group of Amish known as the Old Order Schwarzentruber, who, unlike most Amish, if you drive around Kentucky, and the Amish population has been growing quite steadily, and you'll see them in a number of counties, and usually you'll see the orange triangle. This particular sect objects to it on really on two grounds. The bright colors. Their modesty code says that they should only wear muted, darker colors, and also the fact that it's even in the shape of a man-made symbol, they believe is putting their trust in something man-made rather than in God, and so they refuse to put it on their buggies. They have a significant community in Graves County in far mm-hmm. western Kentucky. They've been cited numerous times by police for not using the emblem, and not only they've fought that, they've been convicted, they've appealed to the circuit court, to the appeals court, to no avail. The courts have ruled the law is the law. As long as it's applied equally to everyone, you don't get a break because you say a particular law violates your religion. And now they're trying to appeal to the Supreme Court. We don't know if the Supreme Court is even going to hear their case. And the judge in Graves County said, all right, we've waited 3 years. It's long enough. She said, here's your time to pay your fine. They refused to pay. So they spent a few nights in jail, depending on how severe their fines were. And now they've got more cases. Two more were on trial the other day. There are more cases in November, more in December. So at this point, it seems to be it's going to be a long-running story.
There's been a bit of irony that at some of these jails, well, most jails, I guess they wear these orange jumpsuits, but they accommodated these gentlemen and gave them a different color.
They did, specially ordered.
That's interesting. So possibly in the Kentucky Supreme Court, but still hard to tell yet. All right. Peter Smith writes about religion for the Courier-Journal. Peter, thanks again for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I want to turn now to your colleague in some education matters, and joining us for that is the Courier-Journal's Chris Ott. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, thank you.
Good to see you again. Let's start with the University of Louisville Board of Trustees yesterday giving President James Ramsey a contract extension that would keep him here through 2020. That's quite a vote of confidence.
Yes, yes. And they said specifically that they wanted to send a very strong message of their support for him. And it was really quite striking, the glowing comments that they gave him and the standing ovation. And so yeah, they're very, very satisfied with his performance over the past 9 years or so that he's been here.
Was this a unanimous vote?
Yes, it was.
So no dissent on the board. Typically, you hear about contract extensions of 3-4 years. This is 8 years. Is that unusual?
You know, I'm not really sure in higher education, but I know that the board members wanted to send a strong message that they want Dr. Ramsey to stay around as long as he is willing to serve in the job. And he's 62. He'd be 71 if he serves out this entire contract extension period. And I asked several trustees after the vote whether that was a concern or a point of discussion even when they met, because they do this behind closed doors when they talk about personnel matters like this. And they all said, you know, there was just no concern whatsoever that he's got great energy and that he served the university really well, and they just want him to stay as long as possible.
What are some of the accomplishments that they point to?
Well, you know, they were circulating around a chart that had about 8, 9, 10 metrics where the university had been in 2002 and where it is today. I pulled out three of them for my story in the Courier-Journal today. The six-year graduation rate, annual research expenditures, and the university endowment, and all of those have grown quite substantially in the right directions, and so they want to see that continue.
Now, he says he has some unfinished business as well. What is it he wants to do?
Well, several things. There are two tax increment financing districts for research parks, essentially, that he wants to get off the ground, one downtown and one on the Belknap campus. He wants to get a Phi Beta Kappa chapter, which is a prestigious National Honor Society, and the university has been trying to get that designation for an awfully long time. He wants to see through the capital campaign, which is $1 billion, which they recently upped the goal on that, and that's set to wrap up in 2014. And he also wants to see through the proposed merger of University Hospital, which we talked about a little bit earlier, since that is, you know, such a big issue, and he played such a role in negotiating that.
I just got about a minute left, but I want to ask you quickly about, you wrote recently about this lawsuit involving the majority owner of Sullivan University and his ex-wife that's been offering some little insight into the growth of the school over the years.
Yes, absolutely, and its profitability. You know, one of the, I mean, as a reporter, you get a suit like that, and it just gives you a real window into the finances of this private business, which normally, you know, would be off limits because, you know, it's not public, don't receive public funding. So those results are not privy to you. So what this shows is that, you know, the school made a profit most recently of about $16 million, and that's risen from about $6 million 8 years ago or so. And many, many more millions that the two owners have cashed out of the school over the years. So it was quite an interesting look at how they're doing.
And you can read about it in the Courier-Journal. Chris Ott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll take a break and be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. The fall meet is underway at Keeneland Racecourse. The Lexington Landmark is celebrating its 75th anniversary this month. But for horse breeders, last month was the high point of the year. Kentucky Horse Farm sold their crop at Keeneland's September yearling sale. As Jacqueline Carfagno reports for Kentucky Public Radio, due mainly to changes in their business methods, most breeders turned a profit.
When the final hammer went down at Keeneland's September yearling sale, almost 3,000 horses had sold, 500 fewer than last year. However, they sold for over $233 million, which represents an increase of almost 13%. Plus, the average value of each horse was up 18%.
I'm Frank Penn. I farmed 45 years. We raised a backing horse operation. Also have some, we grow our own hay, our own bedding, board horses, and my brother and I have horses together. We're farmers that love horses.
Frank Penn's operation is relatively small, but he sold throughout the two-week Keeneland September yearling auction the largest thoroughbred sale in the world.
You can't be a pessimist and be in this business. You just can't do it. And everybody walking through here believes that they can buy the next one. And the reason they think they can do that, and my theory on that is horses can't read. They have no idea who their mother and daddy is, or their sister, or their brother, or whatever. So it equalizes the market out. You know, a lot of good horses have been bought for very modest prices, and a lot of extremely high price horses just didn't pan out.
Despite its celebrity, the horse industry adheres to most of the economic rules that drive any business. Horse farmers must earn a decent return on their investments. On average, bringing a thoroughbred to market costs between $12,000 and $15,000 a year. The investment can go higher if veterinary bills mount up. Mark Taylor, who's vice president of public sales for his family's tailor-made sales agency, adds it's also an investment of time.
Basically, with mares, you have a 11-month gestation period. You know, so you got to you have all that time of caring for the mare, and then the foal is born, and the foal is about 18 months old when it's sold. So, you know, you've got it's a 2 and 2.5 year process to get that baby to market at the September sale.
Making such a huge investment so far in advance is tricky. Fashions in horses change, and so do economic times. A big change recently has been that banks, reeling from their own crisis, have tightened their lending to horse owners. All of these risks have changed the market. Given the high cost, many cheaper horses simply weren't bred. The Jockey Club reports the supply is down. More than 23,000 foals were born this year, as compared to just over 27,000 last year. Besides cutting supply, Taylor says, the way thoroughbreds are marketed has also changed.
You know, it used to just be, you know, you get your horse, you pull it up out of the field, you get it where it's trained to lead a little bit, you brush the mane and tail off, trim its feet, and take it over to the sale and see what people will give you for it.
But today, with tens of thousands of dollars invested in every horse, the entire process is more sophisticated. Consigners like TaylorMade, who sell horses for owners, spend months grooming, exercising, and schooling yearlings so they look their best when they walk into the show ring. And they don't wait until potential buyers show up at a Keeneland auction. In the early years, handwritten notes were sent to potential buyers. With the advent of technology, Taylor says that personal touch has become even more sophisticated.
We've got a really large database, about 13,000 contacts from around the world, that we segment several times a year, and we go back through and we do a market analysis of what types of horses do they buy, and we try to match up the horses we're selling this year with the horses that are similar to ones that they bought in the past.
Keeneland also works hard to attract buyers from around the world. Buyers from Japan and the Arab states have been customers for years, but there are always new markets. Jeffrey Russell directs sales at Keeneland.
We will send two members of our sales team to India after the sale is over to recruit buyers to come here in November. China is at the moment in a kind of a flux. It hasn't quite got anything organized yet. A major country that has increased their participation is Russia, and it is a major market for us.
Amir produces only one foal a year, but during the same time period, top sires can be bred 100 or more times. Stud fees, the fee charged to breed a stallion to a mare, are an important source of income for stallion owners and of cost for mare owners. The cost varies widely depending on the performance at the track of a sire's offspring, the health of the racing business, and the overall economy. Jim Squires, a former newspaper editor in Chicago, now owns Two Bucks Farm, where he bred Kentucky Derby winner Monarchos.
The stud fee ranges have dropped dramatically. We used to have $300,000 stud fees, now we have $100,000 stud fees.
That's so, the upper end now?
Yeah, pretty much. 100, 150. I think Dynaform stands for 150. But with the days of the $300,000 stud fees are seem to be going forever.
In this complex market, declining stud fees and a smaller supply of horses can actually be good news. Squires explains.
What has gone up is the number of horses that get sold, period. But that's because the stud fees are going down, and you come here with less need to make a profit.
Keeneland's Russell says that's why there were smiles at the sale this year.
And the money seems to be spread more evenly this year, too. The median is up in every session dramatically, which means the money has been spread out more. It's not just a high average, it's a high median, which is great for everybody. Everybody's getting a piece of this pie, and that's very important.
But these horses, after all, are bred to race, and that's what keeps people from all over the world coming back to the Keeneland sales. I'm Jacqueline Carfagno.
Jacqueline Carfagno has worked as a business reporter, business editor, and editorial writer, taught journalism, and is now a freelance writer and editor. She joins us now to talk about the piece you just heard. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm just great today.
Nice piece of reporting there.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of minutes here. I want to ask you a couple of questions. Well, like many industries, horse breeders kind of fell on some tough times in recent years, but sounds like they managed to kind of hit the reset button and find a way to be profitable.
Well, I think that a couple of things have happened. I mean, one is, as you heard in the story, that there are fewer horses being bred, and the ones that are falling out of the market are the horses that had the least value anyway. They came from what are called non-economic mares, mares that didn't have great breeding. So, you know, you're just taking that bottom part of the market out, and that really helps raise the average and the median. So the cost of producing, of taking care of a foal and a mare are pretty much the same once it's on the ground. So money isn't being invested in horses that aren't going to make money. So that's been a great help to them.
One thing that struck me is the Keeneland's been sending people overseas to seek out potential buyers in person.
Oh, yeah, they've been doing that for years. I think that's been kind of perhaps stepped up a little, and they are very active. Most people don't know that, but they are very active internationally, finding new markets, nurturing new markets, meeting people, trying to make connections. Keeneland sponsors stakes races in other countries. I mean, Keeneland sponsors a stakes race in Russia and just sent a couple of its executives over to appear at that race.
All right, Jacqueline.
That's one of the kinds of things they do.
Jacqueline Carfagno, thanks for joining us today, and thanks for sharing your piece with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's program, visit WFPL.org. You can also listen to the show again. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.